Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and while the media has been dominated by the news of James Comey's termination, there are at least three major developments in foreign policy that we've been keeping our eye on all week and saying, let's do a segment on that. No, the news on Comey is too big. Oh, let's do a segment on this. No, the news on Comey is too big. So now we're going to do them. Let's not stumble into a war while we obsess only on Washington politics. This past week alone, the Pentagon made a push for an increase in troops to Afghanistan. President Trump approved a plan to arm Syrian Kurds, despite Turkey's strong objection. And the tensions between the U.S. and North Korea just keep climbing. And now, weirdly, between the U.S. and the new president of South Korea. With me to talk about all three of these developments is Slate's military columnist Fred Kaplan. His latest book is Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks.
And let's start with Afghanistan. It's the 15th year, or, well, let's see, it started in 2001, so we're really in the 17th year, depending on how you count, of the longest war in U.S. history. But with so many other headlines dominating this news cycle, it's unfortunately easy to overlook. So who's asking for what kind of escalation?
Well, the Defense Department, some joint staff, and H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, are asking for an increase of, so I read, 3,000 to 5,000 troops in Afghanistan to improve the training of the Afghan military, which keeps getting walloped in any major confrontation with the Taliban. Now, Trump has not made a decision on this yet,
right.
And the leak obviously came from people who are urging him to make a decision in favor of it. You know, Brian, the United States has had up to 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. It didn't, in terms of influencing Afghan politics, in terms of getting them, the regime to be less corrupt, in terms of training the Afghan military, it just hasn't proved decisive. And honestly, I don't see what an additional 3,000 to 5,000 troops will do. And it seems to me, if this is approved, it is the wedge in the door. There will probably be some minor improvements, but then after 6 months, somebody will go to the president and say, Mr. President, I think with one extra brigade, we can really make this work now. You know, well, once you accept the premise of a call for escalation, it is very difficult to either to back away from that or to resist calls for digging in a little bit deeper to improve the situation further.
And listeners, we can take calls for Fred Kaplan from Slate on any of these three stories: the request for more troops for Afghanistan, the report of a Trump plan to arm Syrian Kurds, which the Obama administration would not do, part of the ways of getting at ISIS and maybe even Assad, we'll find out, and the tensions between U.S. and North Korea, and now U.S. and South Korea. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Fred, you write in your most recent column that shortly after being sworn in, Trump ordered Defense Secretary Mattis to submit a report in 30 days on how to defeat ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
Mattis submitted that report, and Trump has yet to do anything with it or even approve it as policy. Where are you going with this?
One aspect of it that has been approved in the past few days is to have the U.S. directly arm the Syrian Kurds. This is actually a legitimate dilemma, and it was something that the Obama administration grappled with and debated for over a year. And at the very end of the administration, Obama decided to step up arming of the Syrian Kurds. The dilemma is this. On the one hand, the Kurds are and have long been the most effective fighting force on the ground against ISIS. And that's true of the Iraqi Kurds in Mosul. It's true of the Syrian Kurds in Raqqa. On the other hand, Turkey, and not just Erdogan, but any Turkish leader would regard the Kurds as an existential threat. You know, the thing about, you know, as I've said this before on your show, a lot of this goes back to the settlement after World War I, when borders were redrawn in the Middle East. And the Kurds got screwed on every front. There was no homeland for the Kurds. They were spread out among Turkey, what is now called Turkey, Iraq, and Syria. And these have become rebellious, more radical over time. They're all related to each other. And Erdogan regards the strengthening of any Kurdish faction to be the strengthening of them all and a weakening of his own authority in the southern part of Turkey. So here's the dilemma. To speed up the defeat of ISIS, do we arm the Kurds and thereby anger the Turks, who might, for example, cut off the use of U.S. planes in an airbase in Turkey, which has made U.S. airstrikes much more effective and much more dense? Or do we, you know, appease Turkey and just kind of let the Kurds go along a kind of rather slow pace, and ISIS will be defeated at some point, but maybe not for, you know, months or even a year from now?
How decisive could arming the Kurds be in the fight against ISIS, or for that matter, Assad?
Well, they don't care about Assad.
Oh, they don't.
I mean, that's one thing about the Kurds. It's the limit. They are interested in defeating ISIS or anybody else in the swath of territory that they want to control along the northern areas of Syria and Iraq. They don't, if somebody said to them, hey, come with us and overthrow Damascus, they're not interested in that. So they could be quite decisive. I mean, they really are very good, and they've long been really good. It could accelerate the defeat of ISIS, which at least on the battlefield, in a tactical sense, seems inevitable at this point. It could definitely have a major impact on that.
Let's take a phone call. David in Yorkville, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Good morning. You've got several situations that put our relationships with allies at risk, Turkey and Korea, but I really want to focus on Korea. The current new government has said they're opposed to our THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System. If the United States decides that that's critical to our defense, because getting Korean missiles down before they leave that region, if we decide that's critical to our national defense, and Trump says, if you force us to take those out, we're going to take our American troops out and leave you guys to deal with North Korea on your own. He's the kind of impulsive actor that could do that and tumble that peninsula into real chaos. What's your thought about it?
Yeah. Well, you know, you're right. I mean, it is the, you know, we are putting this air defense, this missile defense system, and it's operational now. It's on South Korean territory. They're a sovereign state. If they decide they don't want it, if they decide they don't want our troops, that's the end. I don't think that's going to happen, though, because the president is the president, but I just can't imagine anybody trying to do that. You know, Jimmy Carter, when he was president, at one point he publicly announced that he was going to pull out all U.S. troops from South Korea. And everybody in his administration, the liberal faction in the foreign policy, the conservative faction, they all conspired, and I've used that term advisedly, to get him to reverse his stand on that. And it took months. Everybody was in a panic. It's very interesting. When Trump the other day, or a couple weeks ago, said that he was going to make South Korea pay for the THAAD system, H.R. McMaster called up the South Korean leadership and said, don't worry about it. We'll pay for it. And the leak of that came from Seoul, came from South Korea. And by all accounts, Trump was really angry at McMaster for doing that. I don't see that happening. But, I mean, it does illustrate the spot that we're in. If we want to talk about South Korea now, I mean, the big... The big thing here is Trump is trying to increase the pressure on North Korea, to increase it from himself, from China, from the allies in the region. South Korea has just elected a liberal government for the first time in a decade. This party has a tradition of favoring what used to be called the Sunshine Policy. It was accommodation with North Korea. Trade, open up good relations, don't be too threatening, and also don't do anything that might irritate China as well. They used to be a pretty avidly anti-American party as well. That is less true than it used to be. I mean, they do realize now that there is a threat from North Korea, the magnitude of which was not the case last time they were in power. Still, they're very skeptical of claims about the United States. The new president, one of his mottos is we have to learn to say no to the Americans. And, you know, it's very, you know, all of these, to the extent North Korea has nuclear weapons, and we know they have thousands of artillery shells, these are all within firing range of Seoul, 35 miles away from the North Korean border. It's very hard to gin up a region-wide pressure campaign against North Korea if South Korea isn't part of it. So it,
why
it
would we second-guess South Korea if their new president, whose name is Moon Jae-in, has the support of the people in thinking that dialogue with North Korea is better than isolating them and threatening them?
Right.
Why would the U.S. go a different way, since South Korea is really the country that stands to be at risk militarily from the North?
Yeah, well, I think at the beginning of this, it was hoped that this would all have some effect before the old president was impeached, and now she's in jail. You know, while the Conservative Party was still in power. But look, there is no choice now. There is no choice in this matter. Fruitless as recent negotiations have been with North Korea, there is really no choice now but to have some kind of combination of military pressure, but combined with very active diplomacy. And you know, it's worth noting. Some people say, "Oh, this has never worked." President Clinton, in the 90s, did put a halt to North Korea's then plutonium program for several years. It all kind of fell apart when they started moving to an enriched uranium bomb, which wasn't covered in the treaty. That was one of the problems with that treaty. But part of that was brought along about because the United States wasn't living up to its part of the agreement. So, and of course, the politics now completely changed. Once a country that you're trying to keep from getting a nuclear bomb actually has a half dozen or so nuclear weapons, your leverage over them diminishes drastically.
Fadi in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Fred Kaplan from Slate. Hello, Fadi.
Yes, sir. Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a U.S. citizen, Syrian. I have family back home. Mm-hmm. I go every year to visit. Mm-hmm. And to arm the Kurd is wrong, which is Obama and Hillary Clinton arm the group, the rebel, moderate, whatever they call them, and they too many different faculty and too many group, Nusra, blah, 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 whatever. So arming group is no good because you don't know who those groups going to work in the future with who. It's not guaranteed. And also, we do have U.S. Marine in the ground in Syria, north and south, in the border with Jordan. And this is no good also because we're escalating the situation. We need peace. We don't need war no more. Is Iraq in Iraq war, Afghanistan? Iraq war, we have been in 10, 12 years. Where are we at now in Iraq? Or Libya.
Fadi, what about the argument that some people will make that our failure to arm the Kurds or back Iraqi forces more than we did at the end of the Obama administration has led to more war because it let ISIS, with its warlike ways, get such
it's
a toehold?
It's correct. Arming a group. Is no good because escalate the situation and create ISIS, the way you say, Daesh, or it's difficult to defeat them in the future because those cancer, they must eliminate them. They're no good. Those They had no respect for human being. They brainwashed from Saudi Arabia and from whatever fundamental imam or whatever. They call them Al-Qardawi. He lives in Turkey. He lives in Kurdi.
That's the dilemma, Fadi, right? If they're going to expand their war footing and we don't do anything to fight them, well, it seems like this is what some people would argue. I'm not taking this position necessarily, but some people would argue it seems like peace to not arm their opposition, but it lets them expand their war and their dominance.
Yes, we need to fight them seriously. The only who fight those terrorist groups, the Syrian military, the Syrian government, and the Russian and the Iranian, the only those fighting those terrorist groups. And we need to take it seriously. It's because a lot of jihadis in Syria fighting.
Thank you very much, Fadi. I appreciate your call. And Fred, as you said, therein lies the dilemma about what to do in the Middle East. Just tell me one thing about Afghanistan before we run out of time. With this call for thousands of more troops to be added to the current 8,400, there's a NATO meeting in Brussels, May 25th. Is the president expected to decide before that and ask NATO to add some troops, other NATO countries, in addition to the United States?
Yeah, that's the idea. In fact, the general who commands the troops in there says that we will not put any more U.S. troops. The U.S. will not put any more troops in Afghanistan, any more than NATO also puts troops. So it has to be a joint decision. And, yeah, obviously, but before the NATO meeting, Trump has to decide what he's going to ask them to do. I think there are some questions that need to be cleared up there, and that is, well, what exactly are these troops going to do? I mean, is the idea just to assist and advise, as the saying goes, to beef up the training of the Afghan army? And, you know, this has been going on for a long time. What are we going to do that's different from what we have been doing that might actually work? Or are they going to be just counterterrorism troops and, you know, forget about the Taliban, you know, go after, you know, ISIS now has a foothold in Afghanistan as well. Is that the idea? What is the strategy? What is the end point? What are you trying to do with it? And, you know, this is the kind of strategic question that you could also ask in U.S. policy towards Syria, toward North Korea, toward all the problems that we're talking about right now. What is the desired endpoint? Where do you want this thing to end up? I mean, that really has to be the first question you ask. Then the second question is, what does it take to get there? And then the third question is, if it takes way more to get there than you're willing to commit, then do you have to rethink the first question?
On the U.S.
And that sequence has not been, nobody has gone through that sequence in this administration as yet.
On the new questions regarding Afghanistan, Syria, and North Korea, Fred Kaplan, Slate's War Stories columnist and author of Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.